Welcome to episode 119 of the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, all you need to do is install a Mumble client on your computer or mobile device and go to linuxlugcast.com to get the server details. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. If you do not want to participate, just listen. You can connect to the Mumble server going into the listening room or the listening booth room. If you need help configuring your Mumble client, there is a how-to on our site explaining how to configure the desktop client. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss and are unable to join us during the live show, you can send us feedback at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. Leave a comment in our G+ community, which is going away, or MeWe community, which is the bomb, or check us out on IRC on the free node server Linux Lugcast. I am your partial host tonight, Father Finch, and in alphabetical order, I am joined by 5150. How are you, 50?
Very good. Howdy, folks.
Honky Magoo.
Good evening.
Joe.
Hello again.
Last, but certainly not least, Netminer.
Hello, folks.
Our first bit is going to be some feedback from Google Plus or from G+. 50, what have you got?
Yeah, I'd better explain this because I've added a bunch of annotations in the last 24 hours. When I originally posted this, I was a little kind of hot under the collar because what happened, I'll kind of paraphrase it, bring it down. But, you know, we discussed in the last show, I think it was, that this new machine I bought added a hard drive to it and split the second hard drive between Fedora and left the second half open for a true OS install. The reason I did this, and I've been talking about it for a couple of years now, that every time I would see TrueOS booth in at a Linux Fest, they were talking about, yeah, we're using Play on Linux, and you know we're not running Steam, the Linux version. We're running Steam, the Windows version, under Play on Linux, and on the same hardware, you know, we can run the same Windows games as fast or faster than you could natively in Windows. And I've been thinking, okay, yeah, I would very much like to try that. And, you know, the first obstacle is, yeah, sure, you can put a disk in and install it, but grep does not play well. I guess you could make it do so. But without some manipulations, it doesn't automatically find a BSD. And Netminer was pointing out, and it was something, you know, I think I'd read years ago but forgotten about. On their website, they said, yeah, we recommend, I said grep, not grub. Grub is the bootloader. They said, instead of using grub, we suggest you grab this third-party bootloader. What they suggested was Refinder. And so I'd gone through all this, and I'd there are really a lot of ways to get Refinder. It's in the Fedora repo, so you know I could just install it on Fedora and have it on the machine. That would be the way I'd like to do it if I were to install it. But I wanted to see, okay, before I do that and potentially really screw up the machine, let's do it for, you know, boot off another media and see how it works. And I'd spend an evening, you know, beating on UNET booting in Fedora, and it wanted different permissions. And even if I ran it as super user, you know, ran it as root, it still threw out errors. So, And then I tried DD, and that wouldn't work. Something about Fedora was not, well, Fedora wasn't on auto mounting my USB sticks like I would like it to do. And Fedora is one of those distributions that they don't just automatically enable everything, especially if there's could be a security risk. So I certainly understand that, but I was trying to get it to, to auto mount and not having a lot of luck and, seeing it but not being able to get it mounted. So finally I said, okay, fine. I will just burn it to a CD. And that worked. And and actually it's pretty impressive menu on Refine. It's all graphical. And it came up Windows, Fedora, TrueOS. So clicked on TrueOS and dropped me to a command line login, which I didn't think that was so unusual. So I put in because a lot of distri well not a lot, but there's some distributions like some versions of Debian that by default they log in on the command line, and then you have to you want a desktop, you have to run X Windows and bring it up. And then if you want to go into a desktop by default, of course there's just a few configuration files you have to edit to do that. So I thought that's what was going on. And so I started looking up, how do I launch, not being that conversant in BSD, what do I do to bring up the desktop from the command line on BSD? And then finally found this link. And in part of that, I realized I had go back a little. I hadn't installed RPM Fusion, which is kind of the equivalent if you're in Ubuntu, where there's a button in the software center where it says, enable non-free packages. So if you don't change that in Ubuntu, there's stuff like support for MP3 and DVDs and things like that, and even VLC because it does all those things. You can't install it unless you enable the non-free repositories. And RPM Fusion is just like that, and I've got a link in the show notes there. From in the feedback section, and you can enable, you don't have to enable everything, but if you want to be able to do everything, if you don't want any restrictions on what you're doing in Fedora, then just go down the page and install everything. So that's going back a little bit. Okay. So I came across this ItzFoss article. It says, yeah. TrueOS since last summer has completely expunged the desktop, or we should say that eschewed the desktop. You could install it, but then because I went back and looked in their notes, they still haven't changed all their notes. And if you look in their notes, they go to install page, and install page, not only is there like stable, there's you click stable and it's in, which desktop do you want, because they're different downloads, and they don't have that anymore. And I went back to the download page and read, yeah, there it's this is these are all without a GUI. These are command line only images, but you can use the pack command to install a desktop. But I went to this ItzFoss article, and they pretty much said, yeah, TrueOS doesn't want you to install a desktop anymore. And that kind of, I should have done a little more research at before I posted, but this kind of late at night, and I said, I said, how do you go from being a distribution that says, hey, watch us beat Windows at its own game, and run Windows games better. To less than a year later, let's forget the desktop entirely. Okay, what I didn't realize until yesterday and started talking to some of their devs is that the one doesn't have anything to do with the other. Even if they still were a desktop distribution, apparently all of the let's beat Windows and Steam at their own game running Windows native games under an open source operating system, that was all based on Play on Linux, or not, sorry, Play on BSD. And I assume Play on Linux is the same, in the same state, but it was a Python 2 program, and nobody's upgraded it from Python 2 to Python 3. And so that, you know, that's at least, you know, Python 3 has been out at least 2 years now. There was a lot, for a while, you had to kind of run both and watch how you were installing things. But by now, if a Python program wants to stay relevant, I would think they would have to have evolved to Python 3. So apparently there's no developers in the PlayOn program who are interested in porting it over to Python 3. So even if TrueOS was still running a desktop, they would have dropped that whole let's run Windows Steam games. So my apologies to the TrueOS devs and the people who you're making the decisions over there, because you know, having a desktop wouldn't help me out with what I wanted to do. So there are still ways, you know. There is the Trident project that are with some of the developers I've talked to in the last couple, last day, are on with both TrueOS and Trident, and they're pretty much mainly backing Trident as its own distribution. You know, there's apparently a way to get Trident's desktop on TrueOS once I've got TrueOS installed, because they haven't forked very far yet. But one of the things I mentioned in my rant while I looked at it and the latest post is, we just got our first ISO put together, and they said use yet another boot manager. And they said, careful, this boot manager is not compatible with some hardware. And I wasn't particularly interested, you know, in finding out whether or not my hardware was compatible with that particular boot manager. So I really should set up a BSD machine just to be learning BSD. Might put it bare metal on something else rather than this, you know, what I consider my production machine. I still haven't made that decision yet. And if I do want to go to Play on Linux, I guess, or Play on BSD, I'll really have to look for a version of BSD that is just, you know, we're sticking with Python 2 and we're not moving on, which I think that's going to be probably hard to find. In that post, and I put a comment on the post, not that anybody probably would see it, but here I'm going to, you know, really want to apologize to the TrueOS developers, because even if they hadn't made that decision to go command line only, wouldn't have done any good with what I was really wanting to use it for. I did install... they're doing all their communications over a program called Telegram, and it's a lot like IRC, but everything kind of looks like text chat, like you see when, you know, my my chat doesn't look like that on the phone, but when you, you know, when you have these cutesy conversations, they get posted in graphics on YouTube or whatever. You know, it, you know, everything in there looks like that. So I installed that just so I could get the, you know, I wanted to find out why they made the change. And you know, there was a post from let's see, Rodney Myers, who has admin, and put a post in there. It says, you know, TrueOS OS Desktop Edition has been discontinued, and now TrueOS is a distribution platform with its own server-based released images as well. So I did, I PM'd Rodney on the, on Telegram and explained to him, he's the one who explained to me yesterday this whole thing about, well, you know, play on BSD has never made it out of Python 2, and that's why it would have been left behind regardless. And but he said, as far as the decision to go to you know, just command line distribution, he really wasn't involved in that, and suggested a couple names. And then he said, hey, you know, JT, one of the people he mentioned, is on. And so I PM JT and asked, okay, what, you know, I understand the whole thing now about play on BSD, but why did you just, you know, why was the decision made to drop the desktop altogether? And it, corresponded after that, you know, I asked him if I could quote him on the podcast, and he didn't say not to. So in his subsequent communication. So a quote from him is, TrueOS decided to focus completely on the base OS as an attempt to advance FreeBSD by being a testing bed for future changes. An example of this would be TrueOS's implementation of OpenRC and AutoFS enabled by default. And I still haven't looked up to see what those projects are. I've heard of them, but at the top of my head, I don't recall what either one of them does. So that's as much as I know about, you know, what went on with TrueOS and why we're probably not going to see, you know, anything from playing Windows games with the Play On program, at least in the very near future.
Well, okay, that stinks.
Well, like I said, I can't blame the TrueOS people. So, you know, there wasn't their decision not to maintain, and you know, if somebody's out there, you know, saying, yeah, no, we wrote this in Python 2 and we're done, we don't want to learn Python 3, then probably wouldn't have lasted very long anyway.
Yeah, true.
Is there anybody out there, you know, wants to take up the conversion? I mean, there's a project for somebody who understands, you know, is really good at Python.
Like I was saying earlier, there's been continuations from PlayOn. Lutris is the one that everybody is talking about right now. And I know there was been a couple other forks of Wine, including Proton, which I guess is specifically for gaming, but you do still have command line access to a lot of the functions, and I suppose you can try and make it work with something else.
And that's further down in my notes, but I'll mention it. No, not the Lutris part, but I'll mention, you know, seeing that I wasn't going to get, playing games in BSD anytime soon, I installed Steam for Linux on Fedora. Then I put the Proton on, and probably I need to go back to my own show notes on when I first talked about Proton a few months ago. What do you need to click here and there and elsewhere? because I've downloaded a couple games, including GTA 5, that are, you know, GTA 5 is on the protondb.org site, is listed as gold, which means it should work. But everything I hit that's a Windows game comes up, you don't have DirectX 11 installed, which I would think that would be something Proton would be taking care of. So there's probably a mistake in my configuration rather than an error in how that's running. But I just didn't have time before the show to work it out.
Yeah, and I'm not sure off the top of my head. I mean, everything I've tried has either worked or hasn't really thrown an error at all. Just looked like it started for a second and then stopped.
Yeah, and we were talking about wine before the show, and just because it's a little game that doesn't need a lot of power, kind of politically incorrect, but my go-to thing after installing Wine is to install JFK Reloaded. Completely politically incorrect game. Or historical simulation, if you believe the author. And I've never had trouble with it running before. And, you know, a couple times I've tried to run it, and it's just like you didn't click on anything, nothing happened. Tried running it yesterday, and, it started and sort of blanked my main screen and did lock the system. At least, you know, I didn't have any mouse. I had Alt Tab into my terminal and, you know, do a shutdown and restart from there. So, you know, that's still not working. And usually that's something that's real easy to get working. Okay. The other thing I posted, and kudos to Door to Door Geek. He sent a message to me because he knew I was a Pinebook owner and a Pine 64 owner and interested in this. And he also posted it to the Google Plus for the Mini PC show. And I think Wednesday's show was already up yesterday, you know, which is unusual because they were talking about this. And Flying Rich has posted on his YouTube channel talking about this message he got from exact same thing in the link that I posted in the in my G, you know, the same link that Door sent me. And this is something I had talked about that they with my correspondence with one of the Pine founders more than a year ago that I think that I recounted on this show. And I start out with finally promised that I was kingdomed, if anybody out there gets that reference. But Pine has announced a new Pinebook Pro, which is going to be based on the ROC chip. You know, it's using a magnesium case rather than the plastic case we got the last time that, you know, you can sort of twist with your two hands. And 4 gig of RAM, I would have liked at least twice that much, but that's probably what the ROC chip comes with. It's going to be $199 this time rather than $100. You could certainly argue that for $200 you could get a faster Intel laptop, certainly on the secondary market, but no way it's going to be this slim. I mean, this is going to be rivaling the is it the PowerBook or, you know, whatever the really slim Apple laptop is, you know. Also, like they promised me, you know, I said there's not really much of a board inside the Pinebook. You know, is there any chance we can sometime you get a ROC chip board as a replacement? And they're saying yes. Definitely later this year, there's going to be a rock chip upgrade for the 14-inch Pinebook. Apparently, it's going to be a little harder to do it with the 11.5-inch. They're going to try, but they haven't got that worked out yet. But definitely, they've said that there's going to be an upgrade kit for the existing Pinebook. Now, I'm going to have to look at that, see what they're charging for that, and whether it wouldn't just be easier to get the Pinebook Pro. I guess, and I'm a member of the forum, so that's another thing in the letter that they sent out. So if you're not a member of the Pinebook forum, or at least the Pine forum, you may want to get in there if you're at all interested. Because if you're a forum member, you're automatically going to be upgraded from the 64 gig eMMC to a 128 gig. The other thing, talked about the phone development kits. Now, the kit that they're shipping, I don't think there's any way you could fit that in a phone case. So that's just for development, mainly because I think it looks like there's a thing for like a AA battery to run the thing soldered onto it. And of course, that's not going to fit in a phone case. There's a gaming enclosure that will fit the rock chip, the original Pine 64, and actually a Raspberry Pi would all go in there. And part of it is there is like a cartridge thing on top, and that's actually going to be enclosure for an SSD. I don't recall offhand. I can open the page up, see what the two sizes are, but you know, a lot more storage than you would normally associate with a single board computer. So I'm gonna have to look at that. Now, without the SSDs or whatever, that's, you know, I think it's going to, I think less than $50. Obviously, with SSD, it's probably going to go up. So that's going to be interesting. You know, a lot of cool toys. A tablet with specs similar to the original Pinebook. So all of the Pine 64 Pinebook images that are out there would run on this tablet. I think like a maybe 11 or 14, it's a fairly big tablet, I think 11-inch. So if anybody wanted to run native Linux on a tablet, well, this is the way to go.
Which tablet are you saying?
It's going to be a Pine product. Not out yet, but it will be later this year. And it will, you know, have an optional keyboard. I mean, looking at it, it looks like a Pinebook with the keyboard sitting next to it. But, you know, the base kit is just going to be like a, you know, 11-inch screen, you know, touch screen.
And $199, you said?
Well, that was for Pinebook Pro. I don't know if they've priced the tablet yet. I don't think it'd be that much. Link is there. Let me open up the link. I should have it open already. Yeah, okay. This is all from FOSDEM.
Alright, I'm looking through your notes right now to try and find it.
Okay, well, this is still in the feedback portion, not my notes. Like Rich said, he hopes that the speakers will be a little better on the Pinebook Pro than they were on the original Pinebook. The extra $100 may give them enough to make the difference. See, I'm going to be torn when these come out. Like I said, I would expect the upgrade kit for my Pinebook to be probably $100. So do I want to spend that and still have the shortcomings of the speakers, or do I want to spend $200 on the Pinebook Pro? Or probably, knowing me, who's wind up happening, both will happen. Yeah, the phone kits are definitely a dev kit. You know, you're not gonna build a phone out of that. Well, I guess you could, but most people are not gonna build a phone out of that and carry it around.
Yeah. Okay. The Pine Tab, it's looking at $79 and up. But yeah, 2 gigabytes of RAM, 16 gigabytes of eMMC.
Well, essentially, it's going to be like last year's Pinebook, just in a tablet format.
Right.
And I don't know why they didn't upgrade it to Rockchip. Did they start developing it too early? I don't think the Rockchip is essentially, you know, takes up more space than a Pine 64. I mean, I'm sure they would be doing the same thing like they did for the original Pinebook. Is they're going to be, you know, stripping off everything that sticks up, like the RJ45 connector. You don't need that directly on the board. But I mean, it's, you know, and it's going to be hardware compatible with the original Pine 64 and the Pinebook, which means, you know, you can use any of those images and run on it. So I'm thinking it's like you would take the boards out of my Pinebook, stick it in a tablet.
Hmm. And they got the Pine Phone dev kits.
And like I said, they have the Rochambeau retro gaming case. And it does look like a case. I think they mentioned something that this looks like must have been like a Japan-only console. And they call Rochambeau their Chinese counterpart, so I guess that's the name of the company. I'm not sure where that comes from. They keep saying it on the Roadkill show, and I you know, that's California slang I'm not familiar with. I guess I haven't ever looked up. Yeah, I guess it's a Super Famicom inspired case. So I don't think we ever had that.
It sounds familiar, but I don't think I've ever actually seen one.
Well, actually, SSDs, I guess, don't look too bad. Let's see. The case would be $30. The controller, which I assume was just a USB controller, $13, which isn't bad for a USB console controller. And the cartridges, the 128 gigabyte will be $25, and the 256 gigabyte will be $40. I don't know if you need that much storage for, you know, even with all the possible ROMs for retro, you know, for RetroPie or whatever the equivalent is on a ROC board, but
be a little difficult to fill it up.
Yeah, well, you could probably also use as a little server or something.
Yeah, and I guess once you start getting into what the if you can get it playing PlayStation games, then those would take up a bit more room.
Right, and we are starting to get emulators for that, and I assume Sony's probably running around tearing their hair out, though. You know, PlayStation 1, but, right. You know, one of these days, somebody's going to drop, nah, here's a total emulator for PlayStation 4 or Xbox 360 or whatever.
Yeah, but not on... I don't think anytime soon we're going to see it on smaller devices, SoCs.
Could be. Of course, you know, now Odroid has that Nintel SoC. Missed out on that by about a day. They sent the announcement, and you want to order this, and I thought, let me think about it a minute, and by next day, gone. Too bad, they're all gone, for now at least. Probably by summer they'll be back, you know, and be able to sell you as many as you want. And then there's the Cube open source IP camera, and I doubt if it's probably not nearly as big as it looks in the picture. It's probably about the size of the Raspberry Pi camera, maybe a little thicker. So I don't know. I guess it's got its own processor and whatever. Let's see. Does it show? Yeah, I'm not seeing dimensions anywhere. But I mean, it's not going to be a camera to plug into something else. It's going to be its own standalone unit you can take pictures with. So they figure somebody else can figure out how to print a 3D case. So it's, it won't be huge, probably. 128 megabytes of DDR3, 8 MPX Sony sensor, M12 mount. I'm not sure what that is. Oh, accommodates various lenses for different uses. Wide angle zoom, fisheye. Oh, that could be very, very cool. You know, because the, you know, I spent money on a DSLR so that I could, used one where I could actually go buy some telephoto lenses and actually have something to use on vacation, you know, outdoors that, you know, doesn't come out looking like a cell phone camera where everything outside looks like it's 40 miles away. And I've been thinking, man, though, you know, on my carry-on, put the camera in and the lenses, even if I bring one, you know, that's a big chunk of space. This could be very cool. And I think including the lenses, you know, they're saying target price of $20. And they finish up. There's going to be new versions of the Pine 64. They're not talking about, haven't talked about anything about the processor. So I guess it'll be the same as the original Pine. But, you know, let's see. Made the same form factor as the original ROC 64. But I guess new outputs. Well, I guess it is all winter 8.6. Okay. Be looking for that. Though really going forward, probably if I'm going to stay off ARM, probably go for ROC 64, and they've got version 3 of that coming out, including power over Ethernet, real-time clock. Of course, also, that would probably be more important in a standalone, not connected to the Internet, because pretty much everybody gets time updated over Internet now anyway. Improved GPIO compatibility. I guess that would be improved compatibility with the Pi, support for higher speed SD cards, and pricing remain the same, you know, as the current ROC 64. You know, so it you know, depends, I guess, if you're a fan of Pine. I am, but I think there's some really exciting stuff in there. Okay. Father Fetch has had to move into the listening booth, but you know, I guess we'll go on with the projects. I actually did do some stuff projects this in the last 2 weeks. So some of this I've already mentioned. When I say play on BSD postponed pending research, at the time I wrote that, I was thinking I was going to be able to find a BSD that still was Windows gaming oriented or the next best thing, the true OS. But since I didn't have that, I first step getting Fedora ready for games was to install RPM Fusion. So again, that's just so you can run all the non-free stuff on Fedora, and then everything said to run Steam. I had to be running the proprietary discrete video card drivers. Of course, I've got an NVIDIA, and I looked on how to install how to get the proprietary drivers installed on Fedora, because by default, you know, Fedora, you know, being more oriented to openness, they had the open drivers installed. And after playing around and seeing, you know, contradictory things on different websites, I just opened up the, well, my menu just says software. I guess you'd probably want to call it a software center. You know, I just clicked on it and, you know, and found the place to install proprietary NVIDIA drivers, clicked that. And Bob's your uncle, I got that. And to get Steam on, I just did the same thing in the software center. Again, I've been using ProtonDB.com to pick the Windows games to install. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, when I first got it under, well, I guess GTA 4 is what I've done. I've never had GTA 5 before this last week where I bought it. And really, it didn't take more than a couple hours to download. And I'm surprised it was one of those deals where you click on it and says, okay, now we're going to update it, and it's going to take 5 hours to update. But I just immediately getting any of the Windows games, getting DirectX 11 not found. I would have thought Proton would have taken all that into account. So probably somewhere in my settings, I need to go back to where I first installed Proton on Solus and documented on the show. You know, what do I need to click here and there and the other place in Steam for Linux? Obviously, I still don't have something quite right. Went and installed Wine on Fedora, and it isn't quite as easy as just saying, you know, DNF install Wine. So I found a link how to install it on Fedora 29. You do DNF space config dot manager space dash dash add dash repo space, and then there's a link to the Wine's builds repo for Fedora 29. Instead of reading through that, that's in the show notes. And like I said, this is just installing on Fedora. So, you know, if you've got a different distribution, you're going to want to look up install Wine on, you know, said distribution. And then the next step was that just enables the repo, and then you still have to install the program. So it's DNF, and actually this should be sudo DNF, of course, space install space wine aq-stable, and then I had Wine. Speaking of which, completely non sequitur, but it's a good segue for it. I am enjoying this evening. I went for a beer run earlier before the show and caught this out of the corner of my eye. Couldn't leave it there lonely on the shelf. And it's way too much, but it's Johnny Walker White Walker Edition. So I'm sipping on that right now. And usually, I do not suggest, you know, sticking your liquor in either the icebox or the freezer. I do know it makes it easier to get down, but if you're having that trouble, you need to be spending more money on your liquor rather than sticking it in your icebox, because, you know, being cold just kills the flavor. But, you know, when in Westeros, and yes, they do mean that kind of White Walker. I did try sticking it in the freezer. I don't think, you know, it's probably cold enough yet when I got it back out before the show to pour a glass, because it says something on the bottle, you know, incredible transformation when you freeze it. So I'm expecting maybe, you know, when it gets cold enough, the Johnny Walker guy turns into a White Walker, into undead or something. So figured, you know, it's probably worth it just for the bottle as a conversation piece on my shelf sometime. But you know, it's been getting warmer as we've been talking, and it tastes better now to me than it did when I poured it. So much for sticking your liquor in the refrigerator. Okay, and last couple days I've been catching up on my Podnut stuff and listening to the last 4 or 5 episodes of Linux for the Rest of Us, which, if you haven't listened to that in a while, pretty much is just door anymore because of scheduling conflicts. But a few of the things, and I don't want to steal his thunder on anything, but I thought I would mention him since I put it on my system. I meant to run that tonight because I don't know if it'd make any difference. It's Pulse Effects, and it supposedly, when anything that is going through Pulse Audio volume control, it does like inline editing. So there's like a de-esser that I thought would be interesting, and a compressor, and you know, all that stuff that you would run through Audacity after the podcast is finished. This is supposedly does that for you on the fly as you're recording. Dor said he installed it and really played with it. I've done the same thing. Finally got it installed. I installed it using Flatpak for Fedora. So I don't think that's exactly like the same thing as say like Docker. It's kind of like a sandbox, but I don't think it's exactly the same thing. But another way just to install stuff. But they had the Flatpak for Fedora, and so if you hit that link and you just click on the setup button, and that sends it off to the software center or whatever for Fedora, and that pretty much just installed. And then I went back to the PulseFX page and clicked on install, and that sent it also to the software center, which returns, you know, I don't know how to handle this file. So, but if you scroll down on the page, there is a, you know, there's a CLI install. And so you cut and paste that into your console emulator. And it took a reboot because I didn't immediately, you know, I kept looking on the menu. I don't see Pulse Effects. But when it crashed out, I think running JFK reloaded, and I had to reboot the system. When it came back, it was there in my menus. And I meant to mention this last time. I don't think I did. The Fedora that I downloaded automatically comes with the GTK 3, or not GTK, GNOME 3 desktop, which is okay, but I mean, it's like I've mentioned last week or last time or the time before that, I prefer the hierarchical menu. You know, you have internet, games, accessories, office applications, that kind of stuff, segregated, whereas the GNOME menu has, okay, here's your top 5 applications, and I think they kind of picked those for you, at least at first, as favorites, and then everything else, alphabetically. And my installed applications came up to like 2 different pages, you know. So I installed LXDE. I guess there's not an LXQT available for Fedora yet. At least I didn't see one. And then rebooted, and that didn't come up as a menu selection. So I was disappointed. Then fat, you know, but when I hit the drop down list, I didn't realize I had the option before. They had GNOME 3 and GNOME Classic. And GNOME Classic gives me a hierarchical menu, you know, very, very much like GNOME 2. So, shoot, good enough. We'll roll with that until we see something better come along. So that's what I've been doing. So, you know, after a reboot, Pulse Effect showed up in the menus. And like I said, so far, I have no idea how to use it. Other thing, be interesting for this show. Is termed SVG, which you can turn that on. You know, you click that, and then whatever you do in the terminal after that gets recorded to an SVG video file, which is ray traced, which means it can be condensed longer. And exactly like Dore said in his show, it's real time, so. If I'm trying to install something and then I've got to go back in the browser and research the next step and figure it out or whatever, you know, and it takes me 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you know, be sitting there. So I guess probably I could go into a video editor and edit those parts out. And probably if you're going to be doing tutorials, you might want to, you know, actually get it set up on bare metal and then maybe go into a VM. And once you know what you're doing, do all that stuff on a VM. That's probably more trouble than it's worth. But, you know, so in the future, I may be using that, at least try to record some of the installations and, you know, save those somewhere and put the links in the show notes. So if somebody wants to follow along, this is how do you install it, and these are the error messages I got, and etc. The last thing that I've installed so far, but it's not going to be the only things I installed. Dore did a segment on graphical desktop search engine. So instead of using find on the command line to find a file, you have a graphical interface to do the same thing, you know, maybe a little more hand holding, a little easier to use. So he mentioned three, and the one I installed is XSearch, and the link, and this is Dore's link, you know, for installation, that, you know, it's pretty much just exactly follow that along. Just pausing for any comments so far. I know I tend to drone on and on and on and on. Okay. And I mentioned the contact interface for the TrueOS people, and this is users, developers, everybody, is done over a chat program called Telegram. And Telegram is wonderfully multi-platform. There is a version for all the major operators. Well, I didn't see if there was BSD. I think so. And the links are right there in the link desktop.telegram.org. And really the Linux installation is you just download a tar file and unzipped, and then it's got two executable bin files. Well, I mean binary files, are not bin extension, but they're already marked executable. One's marked Telegram and the other one's marked update. And I tried clicking on them in my file manager. That didn't seem to do anything. But I went to the command line, ran Telegram from the command line, and it came up. And it asked you to give it a username, and you do that. And then the first time, at least on the Linux, you know, it asks for a phone number, and then it texts you a an installation code. And you put that in, and that's really all the registration that is required. And to connect to the to the Telegram forum or interface or whatever, for to connect to the forum, I guess if you would call it, for the TrueOS, you just go to the TrueOS page, click on community, and click on the link, and that will launch that link in Telegram. And I thought, okay, well, probably no more I use it. I don't need to install, you know, make a lot of effort getting it in my applications menu. But I went back later after running it. It was right there in my applications menu. So I have to admit, this version of Fedora is a lot better, really, than anything else I've ever had. Some things that are installed non-traditionally, not from the repos, winding up in the application menu automatically. So that's really cool. And then there's Android versions, which I installed on both my Chromebook and my phone. And on those, when they installed, you know, give them my username, and then it... instead of sending me a text message, it sends a message to my existing desktop instance of Telegram. And I get the number off of there, plug it in, and then, you know, whatever I have up in the Telegram on the Linux desktop automatically shows up in the Android version, which was nice, because I'd left that message earlier in the day, and JT, he was on, but probably away from keyboard, and so, you know, that let me leave the room, go sit down behind the Chromebook, eat dinner, you know, and make sure I wasn't being rude, leaving him a message and then not being there to answer it. So, I said, I don't know if I'll actually use it for anything else. I mean, I think we're getting a little, you know, fractured in the way we communicate, you know, having all these different types of programs rather than the old traditional central places. In other words, I'm going to really miss G+. I don't know if that's a plus, because I'm not going to jump on Telegram, you know, see, you know, in a normal day, but, you know,
I have way too many messaging apps as it is.
Right. It certainly doesn't hurt me to install another, but I'm not going to have it up and running all the time. I mean, I'm going to use it if there's somebody in particular, you know, that I want to communicate with, and that's where they are, but... You know, I don't see me having these up and running constantly.
Yeah, I do have Telegram for the Mintcast, but I also have MeWe and Discord and Facebook and Google. Yeah, it's annoying.
Well, like I said, you know, MeWe's okay as far as it goes, but I don't like the fact that, you know, Google Plus, everything that I'm subscribed to, I can just scroll down. You know, get all of it. MeWe, you know, I need to check on this group, and then I need to go to this other group, and then to get the whole thing. Because some of the stuff is posted, you know, sees everywhere, and then, you know, it seems like some of the stuff to see it, you've got to open up that group, and it notifies you when you've got content in that group. But still, it's way more time-consuming, in my opinion. Okay, as far as the new internet provider, I did get the directional antenna for my modem, and It's got like a suction cup to attach to the window. Apparently attaching my south facing window is not the way to do, because plugging it in is actually less. You know, I get less bars that way. What I did is I have not had time, like they suggested, to go take it outside, use a long extension cord, just carry the modem and the antenna, and walk up higher on the hill, and then point it to four points of the compass and see try to identify where what tower I'm connecting to from that, and go on from there. I did, put like a wall bracket on my wall, and because there's a bolt right in the bottom of the thing, and so I stuck it on the end of the wall bracket, and that way, I can rotate it around. And right now, it looks like pointing straight south, and on the wall it's on. Yeah, it's just going through the wood of the building. It depends on the day. I get, sometimes when I plug it in, I get a little better, some more throughput, and sometimes it really doesn't make any difference at all. We talked about the low gain antenna the gain of the antenna that the company suggested, and then finding the ones with, three times as much gain on YouTube. And I thought, well, maybe it's Amazon. Thought, well, maybe it's because I got the wrong connectors and, had to put adapters and they weren't working. And so I went ahead and spent the money, because it wasn't that much, to buy another one of those, if the right connector's native, and still, nothing. I plug it in, I don't get anything. So I don't know. And it's supposed to be more omnidirectional, but so I don't know if that's just not a good product. Probably not. So kind of threw good money after bad on that. But I was, I was hoping get something I didn't have to put up an external antenna. It looks, and run cable all over the place, and run power to the modem. So looks like that's probably something I'm going to have to do to get the speeds that I am supposed to be getting. Because I'm getting better than I had, but not as good. Not worth what I'm paying a month for it. Next thing, we talked about the Mattermost client. And I didn't, I got to a point where I was installing the Mattermost Docker client, and I came to a point I was kind of stuck. I think this was late at night, because I went back to it today and it didn't seem that difficult. I just need to know more information. First I was trying to do my Scaleway cloud server is Ubuntu 16.04. I did an update, and for some reason it wasn't, it wasn't downloading and getting OpenSC. And I think I think it was still updating okay, anything except the OpenSC. It was just throwing me errors on that. And I looked up what OpenSC is, and it's support for a smart card, which is a physical device. Well, since it's a cloud computer, I don't think I really have to worry about, plugging in a physical device. So easiest thing to do was just, remove package OpenSC. That's not the command, but apt remove or whatever. And once I did that, then it went through update and upgrade without any errors. Already had Git installed, I thought, but I made sure And then I had to install Docker, which is sudo space apt-get space install space docker space docker-compose on Ubuntu. Then it has, you know, since you need to change configuration files to tell it whether you want to install Team Edition or Enterprise Edition of Mattermost. Looked up what the difference was. The difference is that with Enterprise Edition, you have to pay a licensing fee. So, no, didn't want to do that. And again, I was looking at the config files and said, well, that doesn't look like what I've got. And then I looked again today and said, yeah, that does look like what I've got. So, but found out like a lot of things, you've got to install a database, either MySQL or Postgres. So I've put another link in the show notes. docs.mattermost.com/install/install-ubuntu-1604.html. That's where I'm following. And didn't have time to complete that with the database installation and stuff, but I think that's a little more hand holding than the Mattermost per page, which I also have in the show notes and was in the show notes last month. But when I hit the impasse on that honky, I looked a little into the Matterhorn that you mentioned last show. But I found out, I got it installed and, you know, served configuration. I said, well, you know, this does not look like a server. And I was right. I went back. It's a Matterhorn is a client that runs in a terminal window. So rather than running, you know, connect to Mattermost from a browser page, you would be connecting to it to like a curl application on the command line, which still that's very cool. And once I get the server set up, I want to complete the setup of that client on my server. So in some, you know, if somehow I screw something up and can't get to it from the web page, then maybe, you know, get to it from a client running on the same computer as the server. That would probably be something I'd want to have as a backup. But one, to make sure you know, you don't want to do any, you know, and you may have already found this out, but Matterhorn is a client, not a server.
Yep, I already knew that. That's kind of what I wanted. Was a command line client for Mattermost. But last week, Joe had actually put in a Docker image for Mattermost, I believe, in the show notes.
Yeah, I think that's the one I'm going off of.
Oh, okay.
And like I said, I got back to that today. It made more sense than it did in the middle of the night a couple of nights ago or last week or whatever it was. But I just ran out of time. The next step is to start, set up like a Postgres server, and I kind of left it at that. I was hoping to have it ready for tonight, but I looked at it and said, no, I'm just, you know, I got these other things got to get done, got to get to town and back, and it's not happening tonight. So cross fingers. I told the Tilts guys, you know, hey, I'm looking at setting up a Mattermost server, because they were looking at their options post G+. And I said, well, you know, I said, you know, I'll set up a server and I'll give all you guys login. So, you know, for what people I have emails for, if I get it up and running and in the next 2 weeks, I'll send you guys out emails, and the ones I don't, I'll talk about on the next show, hopefully.
I thought Joel was saying he set up a Mattermost server.
Yeah, I think he did mention that and how it was never used.
Well, I know you've joined us, Honky, on the Urandom Mattermost server, and you know, don't know, it's more of a replacement for IRC than it is for something like G+, but still, it's a good way to keep in touch.
Yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed it. I mean, pretty much on the Urandom one, it's just, you know, you, me, Taj, and X101.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's a way, you know, once everybody's got a server like that, a way of federating them, you know, so you could go to one interface and see, you know, all, you know, everybody or whatever. Like I said, I mean, I do not want to do my open source business over Facebook, because I got too many people following me on there that would have no idea what I was talking about and get confused. And who is this 5150 person when they know me by the name that's on my birth certificate? And, you know, but we'll try to do as many of these as we can play with and see if what we like best. Okay. Oh, last thing. And I just started on it, and it's only pertinent because I decided I wanted a camera different than the cheap one, cup camera for the hearse. Different from the cheaper one. I'd originally not wanted one of those that hangs over the rear view mirror, and then decided, well, there's not a good place to set this thing on the dash. I don't want to drill any holes to hold it down or anything, or stick it on there, because the dash is kind of fabric covered. And I thought, well, my picture out the rear view is not very good under the best conditions, because the rear door on the hearse is covered with curtains. And so you really only, you know, even with the rear view mirror, you only have this one postage stamp. And it is, you know, till you get used to it, and even after, at night, it gets really confusing, as I've got the plexiglass divider behind me. So anything oncoming towards me, the headlights reflect off the plexiglass and hit the rear view mirror, except for the little postage stamp in the middle is where, you know, actually should be looking out. So, you know, I look, you know, out of the corner of my vision, rear view mirrors, constantly headlights coming at me at high speed from the rear, which are actually vehicles in the other lane, going the opposite direction. And, you know, and even still, every once in a while, it's a little startling. So, you know, and these ones are clipped to the rear view mirror. The way they usually work is it's a camera when you're backing up. There is a wire connects to your backup lights, and then it's a reflective surface. So, you know, the video turns off when you're not backing up. And I'd kind of thought, well, you know, I'd almost rather leave the camera on all the time. And, you know, I was looking for a way to, you know, like power that, you know, run a power line back from the dash and have a switch up there so I could turn on and off. And I was even looking for diodes, because I don't want to turn on and then make my backup lights come on when I'm driving down the road. But then I found out this is, you know, this new backup camera that I got, it's Android powered, has a touchscreen menu, and I can go in that touch. I verified by just plugging everything together, you know, without installing it yet, and plugging it into power, that yes, I can go on the menu and say, you know, show me image from the backup camera. Now, I don't know if that time out or whatever, but there are times going down the road, you know, that the rear view mirror is darn near useless. So, you know, thinking, yeah, I'd rather really have the image up from the backup all the time. The cool things that this will do that sold it on me is it's got speakers, and I can plug it in to my media player and play, you know, play it on headphones, play it through the speakers on the rear view mirror. You know, I was going to, you know, I hated to replace the radio with something modern, you know, would look completely out of place. And I got this cheap one off like Geek or Wish or whatever. you know, $20 radio. I mean, probably sounds horrendous. Probably no worse than the original one from the 80s, though. That, you know, looks but has a an uplink port, you know, that a stereo wire port that you can plug into a device and plug it into that and play your device through the radio. But, you know, this eliminates that. I could do the same thing with this rear view mirror, and I guess hopefully the speakers in are good enough to hear. It also has GPS. You could connect it, you know, you could connect it to the internet. It's got 4G, but you'd have to buy a SIM card. You know, it's got the Play Store. So in theory, you could install Android app. And I guess if you wanted to get a SIM card, you could install Netflix and watch Netflix on your rearview mirror driving down the road. I really don't suggest that, but I think it certainly would be a possibility. Has Bluetooth. I don't, so that you can, you know, you could use your phone hands-free. I don't know if that means you could also tether your phone and use that as your internet. It, you know, might be nice if, you know, occasionally be able to connect and download an app they haven't thought of. Of course, the, well, I'm assuming the navigation app is Google Maps. It's got forward and rear facing cameras. You know, it's one of these things that the thing clips over your rear view mirror is, you know, is a little wider, so it's got room for this forward facing camera to point forward. And so that's a, you know, that works as a traffic cam. You know, if you get in a collision, you can play back the videos on a loop on the SD card that goes in there. And you play it back in a court, say, yeah, it wasn't my fault. Or, you know, I guess if it was your fault, you can swallow the SD card before the cops get there. Let's see, FM radio. Now, I tried to turn that on in the garage. It didn't seem to pick anything up. So I don't know if that's just not very good or if I need to be outside for that to work. And then collision and lane wandering stuff. So, you know, I guess if it thinks with the motion sensors on either camera if you're about to be hit, or if it thinks you're wandering off into the ditch, it's going to beep at you. So, okay, you know, interesting stuff, and get it working. You know, I'll once it's installed, I'll report back on my experiences. Again, this is relevant because it's an Android device.
That's, I don't think I've ever heard of anything like that before.
Well, there's a lot of them out that clip over the rear view mirror, but not that many have that much functionality. Now, I was looking for one like one I had that, you know, the rear view camera just is like a bar that bolts to the top of the license plate. This was just a little camera, either had a sticky thing or a place to screw it in somewhere. And I did not, you know, I did not want to, you know, put holes in my body work or even my bumper. So what I did is I bought a license plate frame at Walmart and just pop riveted this thing to the top of the license plate frame.
Well, that was pretty smart.
Yeah, I wish I thought of that before, because I was going through, you know, of course, if I had, I wouldn't probably wouldn't have gone and found this one. I was, no, I can't get that because it's just got that camera, you know. Of course, the other thing is, I'm sure this camera would work just fine. You know, you could adapt it to like a Raspberry Pi. You know, it's just one of those little cube cameras. You know, some jerk come along and say, oh, free camera, and yank it off the car. So if that happens, I'll probably will have to mount it inside pointing out the rear window.
Right. I'm not sure if there are people who snatch rearview cameras or backup cameras. At least I've never really heard it, but, you know, it's not saying that it doesn't happen.
Well, probably people who would steal something like that are not people who would know anything, you know, what they could do with it.
That's true.
And this is really sad. This is an Android plea. Now I'm in just by length, so I'm past everything that I actually accomplished, but I did have a few links. And there's this Android Police article in the show notes, link in the show notes, that Google has talked about its timeline for shutting down G+. And a lot of things like, you know, the ability to create a new group are coming to the end in about a month, in March. No, February 4th. No, 3 days, 4 days. You will no longer be able to create new G+ profiles, pages, communities, or events. G+ yeah. feature for...
But that seems to make sense considering they're shutting it down.
Yeah, I won't disagree. I mean, at this point, you know, why would you add a new G+ group?
Right.
The Google Plus features for website comments will be removed by Blogger by February 4th and other sites by March 7th. All Google Plus comments on all sites will be deleted starting April 2. Well, I guess that was a feature I didn't even realize we had. G+ sign-in buttons will stop working in coming weeks, but in some cases will be replaced by the Google sign-in button. So I'm thinking maybe if you're using other services like Google Mail or whatever, you'll still be signed in. I don't think that means suddenly you won't be able to get into G+. There will be community owners and moderators who are downloading their data from the community will gain additional data for downloading starting early March 2019. That includes author body photos for every community post in a public community. That's something we might want to bounce around. Do we really do we have any need to say, you know, download the whole content of everything that was ever posted to our G+ community? Because anything that ever was, you know, is posted or talked about in the next show. So is that anything we would really need to do?
I don't think so.
And as of April 2nd, all G+ accounts and pages will be shut down, and Google will begin deleting content from consumer G+ accounts. Photos and videos in G+ users album archive and Google+ pages will be deleted. Photos and videos backed up in Google Photos will not be deleted. Now, anything that I've ever posted to G+ as far as a photo has been uploaded from my hard drive. So I wouldn't have anything that I would lose there. But anybody out there, I didn't know if there was a way to send directly from your camera to G+ and not have it anywhere else. If you've done that and you want to keep that stuff, then you need to figure out how to download it beforehand. But it looks like Google, G+ is gone as of April 2nd, which is, you know, 2 months. I don't know. My personal opinion, the whole security stuff, I mean, if G+ isn't secure, how can we say our, you know, our other Google information that, you know, that anything in our mail account or whatever other presence we have under Google isn't as vulnerable. So I'm thinking that's just an excuse to get rid of a service that was not as popular as they thought it was going to be. Unfortunately, G+ has been extremely popular, in my opinion, among the tech community.
Yeah, I think they were hoping for something like Facebook, and they wound up with something that, personally, I've never used Google Reader, but I mostly just look at this as a way for people to post links to their blogs and, like, blogs. People post the links to things and stuff and then just talk about them. That's really about it. I mean, it's not... I don't think I've ever really seen, at least not many people, use it as a, like, social site where they talk about stuff that's going on with themselves. like one or two maybe, like, and it, even then it was few and far between.
Well, yeah, Google Reader, that was content I wasn't consuming in any means, and I probably should. I mean, yeah, well, so many of the links that I put in here is stuff that I glean off of G+, so I'm going to have to find, you know, I've started subscribing to some of the Linux news sites and whatever, but still, you know, I look at that stuff, and most of it is far less interesting than the stuff I've been pulling in from G+.
Right, because it's all been vetted by somebody else who sits around and looks at all these news articles and then finds the best of them or things that they find are the best and posts them on G+.
Oh, exactly. They're posted by people who are interested in the same things I'm interested in. And, you know, is it the stuff that goes on the news sites, you know, often very, very dry, or, well, I don't know if that is, but, that may be the way to describe it, but it's just, you know, stuff that would be, if there was a Linux newspaper, it would be posted there rather than Linux human interest, that, you know, Linux things that are going to actually affect us, Linux things that are crazy and have no effect on us, but we want to, you know, we want to look at it like going by on a train wreck. Right. Guess the other thing I didn't post, Microsoft has finally given up on writing their own browser, essentially. I guess Edge has had its own problems. I don't know if it's as security hole ridden as
I think it's more that they've given up on maintaining their own back end.
Right. So they're, you know, they're going to, I think for the average Microsoft user, they're probably not going to even notice the difference, but you know, the back end is now going to be based on Chromium. And, you know, one of the things Dorr mentioned, he says he doesn't think he likes that. I mean, you know, because that's just going to paint a big target on Chromium if that's whatever every Windows user is going to use.
Isn't it already?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if I help someone, you know, or if I work on somebody's Windows computer, if they don't have an alternative browser, that's the first thing I install. You know, even if it's just for my own use, working on the computers, you know, I will not use the Microsoft browser.
Yeah, well, speaking of Chromium and Chrome, have you heard the rumors that they're talking about blocking ad blockers?
Yeah, I saw the, you know, we talked about the Linus Tech Tips, which is .r Linus. You know, I saw that article, but it was, or a YouTube video, but it was like an hour. And it's like, man, you know.
Yeah,
you
one of his live shows.
Yeah, can you condense that down for me? But, you know, I'd seen that, but I haven't further investigated it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's true or not. I haven't done enough investigating on it myself. But if it is true, that means it's time to bust back out the pie hole.
Right. Though, I mean, I can see, and I don't know if it's, you know, Google's responsibility to, support the revenue stream for websites. But, I mean, I have heard the argument, well, these people are providing, you know, this information to you, and they're doing it for free, and all they're asking is that you look at an ad. And if the ads are not, you know, obtrusive, you know, where they pop up over the information, or, you know, I've seen several of them, it cannot possibly be a coincidence. You're about to click on the link that you want to go to, and suddenly that ad pops up.
Right, and the link you were going to click scrolls down a couple of inches.
Exactly. Well, or it takes you to another website, you know,
right,
entirely, and then you got to fight your way back. And you know,
or you click on what you think is an article, and then you get about halfway through it and realize it's actually an ad disguised as an article.
And again, this cannot be a coincidence. This has to be intentional design on YouTube that, you know, you play a video and you try to send it up to your Chromecast, and in the first few seconds, you know, the buttons at the top shift back and forth, and it's like, you know, all of a sudden you want to click on Chromecast, and it moves, and suddenly you've accidentally clicked on go to advertiser.
Yep.
I mean, you know, YouTube, you're not fooling anybody, or I should say Google, the parent company. You ain't fooling nobody.
Alphabet.
Well, that's true. Of course, they want to sell the no ads version.
Right, of YouTube. And I don't know. I've thought about it a couple of times because, yes, the ads have gotten worse recently. And I wouldn't mind being able to play YouTube in the background again. And I know my wife wouldn't either. But, you know, for a family plan on that, you're looking at like $18 a month. And, yeah, that does provide YouTube's original content as well and whatever else they've managed to buy up over the years. But is it providing that kind of value at $20 a month?
Yeah, and I might like to go in temporarily. Of all the extra content they put on there, the science fiction series that's kind of like...
Oh, you're talking about Reflex.
Yeah, probably the one that's got the guy who played Malfoy and was on Flash.
Oh, no, I'm probably thinking of something else. This is the one with the girl that has the ability to teleport. It's actually based on the book series, what's it called, Jumper? I'm trying to remember the author's name. They made a movie on it, too, and like four or five books, and I thought the first couple of books were good, but I didn't get that much further into the series.
Okay, well, there's probably a couple things out there on that, you know. Maybe get it for a month and binge watch it all. And this is one very similar. That movie came out a couple of years ago where they're on a Generation Starship, and everybody but certain members of the crew is under cryogenic freeze, and the guy, you know, the guy wakes up, and then he, you know, he gets lonely and wakes up Jennifer, what's her name, from the series where the children have to kill each other.
I'm not even sure.
Mockingjay, or whatever that is.
Oh.
That's not the name of it, but everybody will know what I mean.
No, that was one of the books, though. And, yeah, it was a garbage book series.
That's just an interesting way to describe the movies, where the children have to go kill each other.
Well, unfortunately, that, you know, that describes more than one movie or movie series, but, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking Lord of the Flies for a second there.
Oh, there's that Japanese one where... You know.
Oh, yeah. Or there's that giant contest across the city, and they're all freaking killing each other, and everybody's dying.
Yeah, so there's no end to movies that I could be describing, unfortunately. Shows kind of how morbid our society is. Not to get into a totally, different discussion, but I mean, our entertainment would be... so many ways, like the worst day of your life, you know, the mafia comes in and kills your family, so you have to go out and kill everybody.
Talking or, about Punisher.
Know, all the bad guys. Well, the Punisher, well, that could be any, you know, almost any action movie.
Right. They killed his dog.
Yeah, John Wick. Well, they even made fun of it in Last Action Hero. Yes, you killed my... my favorite second cousin, third removed.
Right.
You know. And I watch those movies too. You know, those are my favorite kind of movies, probably almost. But you know, how weird are we as a society? This is our entertainment.
Yeah. I watched Crank. I had Crank 2 on, but I don't think I could focus on it. Well, I can't say I watched it. Ooh, Reign of the Superman is out.
Yeah, I watched it the other night. It, you know, it's not bad. It's probably not the best of the animated. you know, Justice League movies, but even in that series, you know, I mean, there's a lot of Justice League movies, but not animated movies, but not all connected. But you know, there's probably four or five, you know, in that kind of series, and it wasn't bad. You know, I saw a review of it the other day. Somebody must have looked at it early. And, you know, kind of really slammed it, you know. So it wasn't horrible, but they didn't think it was really very good. And I thought, well, you know, after looking at it, I thought they judged it a little harsh. But then they also said they didn't like Death of Superman, and I didn't think that was bad either.
Yeah, I haven't watched Reign of the Superman yet, but I imagine that's probably a pretty difficult storyline to turn into an animated movie. That was a large, convoluted storyline. I mean, spanning what, five titles, six titles?
Well, that's probably part of it. I didn't, you know, I was out of reading comic books by then. It's probably like a lot of these things. You know, if you read the book, it's like Ready Player One, you know, and everybody says, yeah, the movie's good, or even the movie's incredible, but man, the book just blows it away.
Well, I know a lot of people that really dislike the movie because they really enjoyed the book, and it wasn't a verbatim retelling of the book.
Right. Then everybody says, yeah, if it had been a verbatim retelling of the book, it would have been a 5-hour movie.
No, it would have been longer than that.
Really?
Plus, you'd have never been able to get all that licensing in there.
Right. It's, you know, if you look at everything, it's amazing as much as they did get.
Well, it's because of the director. I mean, 90% of the nostalgia in the movie was Spielberg.
And, you know, everybody seems to love the Lego movies. I watched, like, you know, the first, just, you know, the one was just the Lego movie. You know, not the Lego Batman or whatever, but Batman was in it. And then, you know, I kind of like that parody, I am Batman parody sort of thing. And, you know, I got through 30 minutes of it, and that was as much as I could stand. And I guess the new one's out now. But it's, like I said last week, Reign of the Superman, I got that for free on DC streaming. Now, there are some other...
I wanted to ask you if you'd kept up with the Young Justice and how that's going.
I did. In fact, it dropped just after our last show, and then I started watching it, and sometime in between I fell asleep, so the next day I restarted, you know, watched all four episodes over again. And definitely I never got to the last one before I fell asleep watching it. And, you know, just because it's late night and I was tired. Not that it wasn't good, but I mean, the best of them was the Beast Boy centric one, and, you know, something about Horror of All the Monkeys or something like that. But, you know, it filled in Beast Boy's backstory from, you know, where they left him in Young Justice series 2 till, you know, where we catch up with him, because he's not really a main character. Other than the one episode, he has not been a character really this year. I mean, the whole Young Justice Outsiders, that's really following the Outsiders comic book series. So there have been cameos from other Young Justice characters, But pretty much it's been Nightwing and the Outsiders characters front and center.
So they done until the second half?
Yes. There's really nothing for a couple weeks. And then Doom Patrol starts up. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cool thing, I mean, you know, he puts on... Beast Boy puts on these goggles, which are VR goggles, which are actually meant to test for, you know, people have met that are metas, and he gets pricked by a hypo in the thing, and it does mind control and tries to get him to go to, I don't know, Rialto, California, something like that, someplace in California. But you know, the other McGon's influence in his brain sort of takes over, or whatever. But they do this whole, like, if anybody remember the Supernaturals episode Changing Channels?
Nope.
Okay, it's one of my favorite episodes of the Trickster. You know, trying to get them to play their roles as hosts for Michael and Lucifer. And this is not going to make sense to people who don't watch Supernatural, but puts them in TV, keeps jumping them through TV shows. You know, they're in a Doctor TV show, they're in a Japanese game show TV shows where everything is meant to hit them in the balls. I probably shouldn't say that on this show.
Sounds like the movie Switching Channels.
Exactly. Very much like that. And then the whole Beast Boy thing was, you know, you get his whole backstory, and, you know, it's like he became just like we saw in Titans. Well, you guys have probably seen Titans, but, you know, he was Beast Boy is a member of the Doom Patrol. And well, first, you know, we did see in Young Justice season 2 the death of his mother, and he gets adopted sort of by McGon, Miss Martian, and then that's the last thing we know. And after that, he joins the Doom Patrol because the character in there that, if you saw the Doom Patrol on DC streaming, which probably nobody has, and I didn't realize at the time, the Elastawoman, former actress or model character, was best friends with Beast Boy's mother, who was a former actress, and Beast Boy's godmother. And so, you know, there's a whole thing in there. They do Doom Patrol Go. So, you know, everybody, you know, I guess they had Young Justice after the show was over. There was an episode of Teen Titans Go where they actually had characters from Young Justice on the show, you know, saying, you guys need to be more serious, quit being so childlike. And so they returned the favor. And so they did the Hello McGon or Hello Megan parody. And it's like, no, I don't recognize you. You're not born yet. You know, from his mother's character. And then they jumped to Doom Patrol Go, and so everything was all the characters were made to look like Teen Titans Go characters, that sort of animation. And apparently the whole team died, which is why he's no longer other than Gar. So that part was going on. We have to all go die now. Other than there's another character added who was married to Elastic Girl, who was Beast Boy's stepfather, and man, I am probably butchering all this, not stepfather, but godfather. And so, you know, all of Doom Patrol dies, but this guy who sneaks out, because he's sort of a, you know, he's sort of not a perfect person, you know, letting his wife and all die, and then uses his godfather status to take custody of Beast Boy from a gun, and then, you know, and since he's an actor, you know, sticking Beast Boy in the Star Trek show, where since they don't have, you know, he can do his own special effects, you know, said, oh, he's a Martian and he can morph into all these different things. So they don't have a special effects budget. They just have him, you know, morphing into different things. And then at the end of the episode, it's like, well, you know, you could really use your talents actually being a hero again, instead of being the silly actor thing. So, but, and I'm explaining it really, really bad, but that was the best episode all season and brought everybody update on Beast Boy's backstory. So in the second half, I expect him to show up a lot more. I'm surprised. There was like, you know, there is a Teen Titans versus Justice League animated movies, but that's not on the DC streaming. So that may be new enough. It's still tied up in, you know, distribution rights for somebody else. I imagine all that stuff will eventually show up. And, you know, Dan talked a lot on the last tech show about the Marvel service and all that. I do know on the DC, I don't think any of them's really very current, but, you know, if I had time to go back and read 30 years worth of comics, it's all there. Okay. Also, link to the One Mix 2S. It's another mini laptop. Looks real good, but still $600. It's too much for what it is. It's a Lilliputian article.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I mentioned this one the other day on the Linux Link Tech Show.
Oh, I think you did. I came upon this independent, but yeah. You know, I like to point these out for, you know, our listeners who may be able to think they can afford one of these. It's, right, you know, $600. It's, you know, for what it is, it's more than what I'm willing to spend.
It looks almost exactly like the GPD Pocket 2, except the screen flips all the way back. I think it's got slightly better stats.
And you mentioned the GPT Pocket 2. There is an early review that you probably saw,
yeah,
on Linus Tech Tips. Well, I say he says it Linus. For the GPT Micro PC, which was the $300 unit we were talking about 2 weeks ago.
Well, he also did a review on the Pocket 2. So.
And a lot of the difference being the micro PC does not have a touchscreen, which probably is a lot in the way of bringing the price down.
I think it's got a slower processor and less RAM as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think, I'm sure, but I mean, I was looking at it, I was thinking that was not enough to maybe explain the price difference, but no touchscreen, which I'm not sure I think is a bad thing. You know, because it obviously does not fold all the way around to be a tablet. So if you can't fold it around to be a tablet, why have a touchscreen?
Right.
But his earlier view, you know, says this thing is really slow and not responsive, but he does admit, you know, these are early days and the drivers have not been optimized. And considering the Kickstarter is not even active yet. I know, I haven't checked in a couple of days. you know, it's unusual to have for them to have a working prototype to actually send out.
Right.
And of course, and he said, Linus said, you know, we usually on this show do not talk about crowdfunded things because you never know if you're actually going to get anything. But GPD has a good track record, and yeah, they've got a working prototype they can send out. So it's not total vaporware.
And the biggest thing I got out of his statements about the Pocket 2 was that it was much better keys, much better touchpad, because the Pocket 1 only had the nipple. And the overall processing speed was much faster, noticeably faster.
And again, the Pocket 2, I think, is a productivity machine. It's not intended as a gaming machine. Some of the GPD stuff is intended running Windows as a hyper mobile gaming machine. And the micro PC is, you know, if the Pocket 2 is not a gaming machine, the micro PC sure as heck is not a gaming machine.
Well, they've had lower end stuff that they call gaming. I mean, the GPD Win, the GPD Win 2, and that same small form factor, it was running Windows, but it had controls built in on it.
And of course, gaming is moving target. I mean, gaming 5 years ago doesn't take the processing power gaming today does.
Right. So I'm sure that the Pocket 2 would do just fine as a gaming device, as long as, you know, you're not trying to play the newest, best, most graphically intensive games.
Well, it's like this new machine I have. It's an i5, not an i7. 16-gig RAM. Decent video card. I have not tried gaming in Windows with it yet. I'm assuming I can play things like GTA 5, which I bought, and Battlefield 1, which I've been wanting to play for a couple years now, or at least ever since it's come out, whatever that was. And I'm assuming I can play it, but not with everything turned out all the way to 10.
Right, and had a 1050?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't actually used the 1050, but the comparative benchmarks for the 1050 over like the 970, I don't think you're getting a whole lot.
Well, we'll have to see. And like I said, I do have the option probably of, if I'm very careful because it's not a very long slot, upgrading the video or moving the whole thing into a bigger case. And like I said, I think the main bottleneck is going to be 2 gig of RAM on the GPU. Last thing I had, and it's a Kickstarter, and it's nothing I'm promoting because it's not something I would probably buy, but some people might be interested in this. It's a external touchscreen, connects by HDMI, has like an internal battery for mobility. I don't know how long that would last, but a 16-inch touchscreen and comes with a cable to connect to the phone with HDMI, or obviously PCs with a regular external HDMI cable for second monitors on the PCs.
Okay, so it's touchscreen. That's why it's so much more expensive.
Right, yeah.
Because I picked up a 15-inch USB-powered monitor for like $65 at Micro Center.
Yeah, and back in the day, a few years ago, this all stuff with the fire, you know, I think it was Pat had this and from the tech show, or maybe Link, And then I saw their link was a hinge screen for a laptop, you know, for a desktop replacement laptop, which I had at the time. Didn't ever really take it out mobile, but, you know, you could Velcro this to the back of your, you know, or the top of your case lid on the laptop. And it was like another 15-inch screen or 17-inch screen that would, you know, swing out on a hinge.
Oh, you mean like the Slide and Joy?
I don't think it was the brand. Similar like that, but it,
right.
You know, it was like a VGA connector.
Oh.
Because I think this was pre-HDMI.
Well, the Slide and Joy is still, unless something has changed recently, it's still freaking vapor hardware.
Well, yeah, that there was like after that, I'd also bought a USB external monitor, which was, you know, a lot cheaper. I was actually thinking, you know, carry that around. Oh, I'd have three monitors on my laptop. But, you know, it was like, yeah, I think it's USB 2, but this is, you know, this is going to be more for static pages. You're not going to do video on this. But, you know, the Linux development of drivers lagged way behind Windows. So I got this and I don't think I ever, you know, was able to use it.
Mm.
You know, wasn't that expensive though. But these things, what are they, about $200?
Yeah, on the Kickstarter page there, yeah.
You know, for that money, not something right. I would ever use, but maybe there's some road warriors out there who is like, this is the thing I've been looking for.
Well, it's also display link technology. And yeah, if you have a really good laptop, then display link technology will work well for you. But it's really not optimized for Linux. If you're running any kind of, you know, lower end device, and it might work okay with one display link item. But if you're running any more than that, it's just going to eat your processor.
Okay, because the examples they showed, of course, you know, they didn't talk about Linux at all. They talked about connecting it to a phone. I don't know if they even included Android in that.
Yeah,
they may
all, you can.
You know, so it's like meant as a really big display for a phone. And they also talked about a MacBook. And I'm assuming for what you said also, Windows laptop would work as well. But
absolutely. Yeah, because the drivers for Windows have been optimized. So you don't get that CPU. Well, obviously there's some CPU overhead, but not the same kind of massive overhead that you get with Linux. And there is an app that you can add to your phone to make Display Link work from your phone, but you will need a powered hub.
Okay, glad you studied up on this, and added that information for our listeners who might be looking at this and saying, yeah, that's exactly what I've always wanted.
Yeah, unless you need the touchscreen functionality, then you can get a USB powered monitor, 1080p, 15 inches for like $65-70.
And I've ignored their other pull-made posting. Joe, you say 3D printing ain't easy.
This is true. 3D printing is not easy. Everybody makes it look easy. It's really not. I mean, there's a lot of things that you have to take into account. It's not as easy as just turning on the thing and telling it to print whatever. There's a lot of things involved. There's a high learning curve. I mean, print bed leveling, different materials, different temperatures, extrusion speed, the extruder tips, all of it. And, you know, I've had more misprints than I've had good prints so far, but I am learning. It's getting better. My bed is now level. My prints usually stick. I got to figure out if one side is kind of dipped lower down or not. But right now I'm having problems with brittle prints. Anything with any type of arm, you know, you sneeze on it wrong and that arm breaks. So I don't know if I'm might be under extruding. I might need to clean the nozzle again. It's a learning process and I'm picking it up. I'm watching all the YouTube videos that I can on 3D printing and I'm reading every article I could find about making my 3D prints better. And I like my printer, but I probably am going to do some of the suggested mods to make it better.
That's probably always a good idea. When it comes to your prints being brittle, have you looked into the infill?
I have. I've adjusted the infill. That helped some. I made this Echo Dot holder, and it's got like four long arms on it. So the first time I printed it, it snapped before I even took it off the bed. So I went and checked, and I increased my infill from 20% to 80% for this print. And that helped a lot. And I also made sure that the supports were printed and holding it up, and they were pretty sturdy. And it came out looking right. But as I was removing the supports, one of the pieces broke. And, you know, okay, it can still be held up because it broke near the top. It could still hold the Echo. So I put the Echo device in, and another one of the arms snapped about halfway down. So like I was saying, it's still extremely brittle, and it broke on a layer. So I think it's a problem with under extrusion. Either that or it was just too cold out in my garage when it printed, and it cooled too fast. But I'm going to have to try out everything until I get it working right.
Yeah, they're not quite ready for just consumer devices for everybody to just plug in and go with. I'm personally waiting for, you can say, tea Earl Grey hot, and right. I'm not that big a fan of Earl Grey tea.
Right, and I want to print out this VESA mount converter that would hold up my tablet. But if I can't trust the materials, then I'm not going to put my tablet in it.
Well, right. It was like, you know, I mentioned earlier I put on to mount the antenna for my 4G modem, since obviously pointing it out the window was not the correct direction. So I could rotate it. I actually used a shelf bracket, put it up on the wall. Well, my first iteration was to, you know, use 3M sticky stuff, put it up on the wall because I did not want to drill holes. Well, that lasted about 24 hours before it fell to the floor, and I had to find a stud and drill holes in it.
Well, I've had a couple of prints come out relatively well, you know, usually flatter objects or objects that are fairly solid. Like, I printed off a couple of headphone hangers for off the side of my desk, and they just, you know, slide onto the desk and hold up my headphones, and that works really well. And then I printed off another hanger that folds down. It prints in two pieces, you put a bolt through it, and that also can either be screwed on or stuck on with 3M tape. And I was considering getting some 3M tape and sticking it on, but now I might just use the screw holes that are there and screw it into whatever. And that one works well. I mean, it folds up and folds down, and it'll stay in the up position really well. So
yeah, I'm glad to hear that, you know, works. You know, it's like I hear the guys on the makers, and it's like, you know, yeah, we adjusted this fill and we did this, or didn't need to be nearly as filled, and you know, we took it out, and you know,
we had three wall thicknesses, and We turned the infill down to 15% to make it print faster, and it came out like this, and it looks pretty good. And we use acetone to smooth out all the edges.
I mean, it just sounds like wizardry to me.
Yep. And then I was listening to some guys talk about the different materials that you can print, and it's just insane. I mean, nylon, Teflon, PETG, ABS, PLA, and more that I can't even name off the top of my head, but, and the different temperatures that they need. I mean, there's a bunch of them that there's no way my printer could even get close to, but they still sound cool.
And who was it? Tom from SMLR? Somebody said, yeah, we've got new glow-in-the-dark filament.
Yeah, I picked up some glow-in-the-dark filament and some ABS, but I'm a little wary about printing with it after I did some reading, and it turns out it's very abrasive and very hard on your extruder. So I might wait and see if I can pick up some extra extruders before I start printing with that particular material.
And while I talk about SMLR, I guess, I have to admit I have not caught up on the last few episodes, but I guess Mary's left the show, so.
Yeah, a while ago.
Yeah, wherever you are, Mary, you know, best wishes and everything, and hope to see it PenguinCon and OLF. Oh, you know, and on that, JT from TrueOS, you know, he put on a thing, well, where have you met people, you know, at a TrueOS booth? And I thought maybe he was, he's thinking, well, I don't know. I didn't know we had people out there at TrueOS, but he clarified later. He says, you know, I've been to OLF and Linux Fest Northwest, and was trying to figure out if I'd met you at a booth, and I told him, well, certainly we've probably passed each other in the hallway, so even if I don't use TrueOS, I'll have to make an effort, try to look him up at a fest where they have a booth and say howdy.
Oh yeah, and I wanted to mention that I haven't even gotten into making my own designs yet. I'm still printing stuff that I find and like on Thingiverse.
Oh yeah, that's the part that, you know, really seems like magic to me. You know, let's make this, or yeah, I broke this thing. Rather than just ordering a replacement, let's just make a new one.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Well, Honky was going to talk to us about FFmpeg.
I just wanted to share a couple of commands that I found that may be useful to some people. So I've been trying to work with the audio from the HBR New Year's Eve show, and I have been having a hell of a time with it. I bring the thing into Audacity, and I would combine some of the, because it was, Kay Wisher had it, so it was like every 3 hours it would stop and start another recording. So I have 10 three hour recordings. And so I'm trying to like put some of these together, or try to put all of them together, and then try to, because where they break off is a lot of the times it's in the middle of a conversation, or even sometimes like in the middle of somebody talking. Like if you can line it up in Audacity, and you know, obviously it won't miss a beat. And like I said, the audio is all there, but then I try to export the audio, and I don't know how, but it all gets like something that is clearly like, I tried to put all of it together, and when I tried to bring it out the other end, it came down to like 6 hours or something, which it obviously was not. And I'm having just a hell of a time trying to work with this audio. I think I'm just going to have to work with it just like in little sections at a time. And then, I don't know. I'm still playing with it. But one of the things that I found was all the audio files were labeled as WAVE, but they were actually a audio type that I'd never seen before called AIFF. So what I wanted to do was, one of the ways I wanted to try to combine all the stuff together was through SOX. And SOX didn't recognize the AIFF, and they're all labeled as WAVE. I'm like, SOX should know what WAVE is. I've used SOX with WAVE files all the time. So when I went, one of the times when I went to save one of the files I was working with, and it defaulted to wanting to save to an AIFF file, I figured, okay, I'm going to have to, maybe I'll try renaming all of them first. So I went and renamed all the files to .AIFF files, and then I used FFmpeg and this little script that I found to batch change all the AIFF files to WAV files and keeping their original names. Basically, the names they were before, I even wound up changing beforehand anyways. I mean, it was... they were like date stamp type names, and I just basically changed them all to like 1.wave, 2.wave. It was just easier when you're typing things in the command line to type that as opposed to the full like date and time. I am not going to read out the command. Please check the show notes, but it's if you ever want a quick reference as to how to convert, and I'm sure this can be used with other... FFmpeg supported probably audio formats, maybe other formats, so you could probably change the AIFF into something else like WAVE to MP3 or something like that. But it's a nice, it did a really good job of changing all of them into WAVE files. But again, I did SOX is a great audio command line audio editing tool application. In SOX, basically all you'd have to do is take, you know, SOX and then line them all up 1 through 10, you know, .wave, and then the file that you want to be like hprne.wave, and it would combine it all together. But even after I did that, it didn't. I'm having a hard time here, but... So... another thing I wanted to share was there is a way in SOX to truncate silence. And there's there's a script I have in my Mumble to Podcast script that I run to do the audio editing for this show that works, I want to say, about 70% of the time. I had gotten several shows that gone out where it didn't truncate the silence as well as I had hoped. It just didn't seem to do it at all. And then other times it works perfectly fine. So another one, Kay Wisher had sent this to me, and, he says he's been running, after he's using, I don't know whether it's like a G-Potter or something like that to pull all of his stuff in. And then after it gets pulled in, he has it run through like the truncate silence script and maybe some other stuff. But he said he's been using this for everything afterwards, and he hasn't been having any problems, or, you know, everything is doing a good job of truncating silence. So I figured I would add that to the show notes for anybody who maybe doing their own truncate silence on podcasts and stuff like that. That they listen to. Yep, that's it. I've really just been bashing my head against the wall with a bunch of audio files. I've been playing around a little bit with the GNOME cubes. So I got GNOME cubes installed. I got it. I started playing around with it. Ran into a couple of issues right off the bat. It seems like it should be really, really easy to get up and running, but I've run into I'd haven't documented where some of the errors were. I think I know what the problem is. There's something in something I have to disable now. Again, I documented the scripts I've been using, but I didn't document the problems I've been having with GNOME cubes. Let me see if I can find them real quick. There is boxes. I'm sorry, I keep on saying cubes. It's GNOME boxes.
No, I've also recently done some podcast audio editing. It was actually kind of fun. I did it for the most recent episode of Mintcast, but I just did it all in Audacity, including the truncate silence. But for some reason, the timing was off on everybody's audio, and I had to go back and redo it all again and just randomly basically clip out sections of silence to get everybody's audio to match up, and I don't know why.
Well, I've heard mumble after about 30 minutes. If you're doing individual recordings, it gets jumbled.
No, this was everybody's individual Audacity recording. I mean, we'll use Mumble for our discussion, but we'll also be recording with Audacity.
And that's why I really like downmix. I think most days is good enough.
What does downmixing do?
Well, that's what we do now. You know, that's how we're recording now. All the Mumble feeds go, you know. One recording. I mean, there are people who argue, it'll be better if everybody does their own individual recording and sends them in, and we combine them, and wow, that seems like a lot of work. Now, like the last show, I was recording for part of it and gave it up, because I haven't had any artifacts at all this time, and I was having a bunch of artifacts last time.
Yeah, it was a couple hours worth of work.
And Honky, while you're looking for stuff, I'll say, don't feel bad. I think my earliest show for HPR was talking about FFmpeg, and I really didn't understand it myself. I was just parroting stuff from other people.
Oh, I tell you, there was... earlier on, Kevin and I did a... No, he helped me out because, I have a hard time just trying to do a podcast of me just sitting here talking to myself. I liked having somebody else to bounce stuff off of. I did one earlier on where Kevin helped me out, where I talked about the Debian sources.list. So the thing that got put out sounded like something that was actually, it sounded like something. There wasn't a whole lot of pauses. There wasn't a whole lot of empty space. There wasn't, I went back and I did a lot of editing on that.
Well, I do an HPR. I almost have to have a total script. It could be something I know. And even have an outline, and there's just all kinds of these hemming and hawing. I just pretty much have to have the whole thing scripted before I start. I mean, most of the stuff I've done for HPR, just download the show notes, and you'll have the thing. Maybe even more concise than me actually saying stuff.
You did one a while ago that I need to go back to, which was the... SSHFS, how to set up an SSHFS.
Well, I do that all the time. It's just...
I love SSHFS.
It's something I need to learn how to do.
Well, I even set it up so that when my network disconnects, it automatically clears out the SSHFS. And when it reconnects, it automatically resets up the SSHFS.
It's something, there are some distros that SSH is not installed by default, but, usually you just have to install OpenSSH.
Well, if you're going to set it up the way I did, then you also have to make sure your network keys are set up, and I did have to go, install SSHFS itself.
Yeah, well, I think that, You need to do that too. And, well, I mentioned on the show, you know, that the Solus people, you know, said, oh, exchanging keys is not secure. You need to put in the password every time.
Well, like Honky was saying earlier, this is all set up for my internal network, so.
Right. And I need to catch up with that, but it's just every time you put another machine online, and you got exchange keys with the server.
Joe, I have a question I was told you might be able to help with. How do you get a rugged, affordable gaming laptop?
Well, I'd say the first place to look would be Facebook Marketplace. Rugged gaming laptop? What, you mean something heavyweight? Like
my brother believes that he's chasing a game which is going to discrete video only soon. And he lives in a truck. And all of the gaming laptops that I've seen don't seem like they're rugged enough to survive very well, at least the affordable ones.
Right, right. Well, just get something that's a generation or two back. Like I said, look on Facebook Marketplace. You can find the MSI GE62s, which are 15-inch laptops, and they do gaming really well with the 960Ms and the 960Ms, the 970Ms. And I picked up mine for $600, and that was the 72 instead of the 62, so it's a 17-inch model.
Okay, Facebook Marketplace. Just that, everywhere you look, it's very hard to find them. And quite frankly, some of the low-end stuff that you can actually get, like at Walmart or whatever, I wouldn't trust.
Well, Linus from Linus Tech Tips has mentioned that the... Well, I don't think they're for sale anymore, but the $800 gaming laptop that they had from Overpower at Walmart was actually decent.
Well, decent is one thing. I'm wondering about survivability.
Right, right. And in a truck all the time, I could see how that would be an issue. But it also depends on what type of gaming he's planning on doing. I mean, because it's not really a laptop, but we were talking about it earlier. The GPD Win 2 is a gaming device. It's just a handheld Windows gaming device.
Well, you guys.
Well, quite frankly, I think you'd have better luck getting a small form factor and mounting a TV in his sleeper, but he has rejected that solution.
It sounds like a good solution to me. I mean, even if it's just one of the USB monitors that we were talking about, you can still get pretty good on that.
Well, he has a TV mount in his sleeper, you know, for 20-inch TV or something, and he has electrical 110 electric power. But trying to squeeze a laptop into so that he can take it with him when he leaves the truck to go into his truck stops or terminals, I think that's a bridge too far.
Yeah.
Well, now they don't have dedicated. They don't have the high-end graphics cards like you're talking about. But if you look at like the 2016 and 2017 or older Razer Blade Stealths or the Razer Blades, I mean, those seem fairly sturdy and they're lightweight and good processing at least.
So is he wanting to play games, or is he actually just wanting to watch video?
He's wanting to play games. He wants to play World of Warships, and they're telling him that his current laptop doesn't meet their minimum specs, and that the next patch is going to make all Intel integrated graphics will no longer be supported by the game.
Ah.
And the problem I see him having is that if he buys something, the next patch may well jump the mobile gaming capability that he's going to spend $800 for.
Yeah, I mean, that's a game I would really like to do, but it is not, you know, does not look very much Linux compatible, you know, running in an emulator.
No, he's running Windows 10, but I'm just saying that he wants a rugged gaming laptop, and that's like an off-the-road Ferrari.
Yeah, it's not something that you're easily going to find, so you're just looking for something that's stable. Now, the Alienwares, they do seem stable, but they also seem overpriced, even used, for what you get. But they do look like solid builds, like tanks. And the MSIs is probably his best bet. Or, you know, the overpowers, if you can find them.
I will try to remember to recommend this, but then again, since it looks like a train wreck, maybe I'd better step back.
Well, yeah, you can't really go wrong recommending the MSIs. And like I said, you know, I don't see the 960s being obsolete for a while. I know it's now two generations back, but even still, they're going to stick around for a while.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it seems like most of the rugged build laptops are based on Intel graphics. So
actual rugged machines listed as rugged. They're not really going to have graphics in them, and they're not going to have the type of airflow that graphics need.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that I would look around at some of the other warship games. War Thunder has a marine section, I think.
Now, I wonder if he could maintain good networking, which I assume that game would need anyway, if he could just thin client it.
Well, he's rejected any kind of thing that would tie him to the truck. He needs a portable solution.
Well, even with that, with a laptop, I mean, he's still going to need to connect to Wi-Fi, right?
He connects to Wi-Fi. He spends an arm and a leg up to the knee on cellular internet.
Right. So what I'm saying is that he has a computer at home with good graphics set up and ready to go and running Steam or whatever backend it requires, something that will allow him to stream to his device.
Yes, but that would mean that he would have to rent a home.
You have a home?
Yes, and I'm not... Well, I do have a home. And I'm not willing to be his sysop.
Yes, this I understand as well.
Also, I have a DSL connection. If I'm using my network to run his system, what are the chances of him objecting to me taking bandwidth?
Right. With the DSL, that would be kind of crappy because you're really looking at upload speeds for him.
you know, if it is realized the way it is advertised, and like I said, my neighbors are getting this, I am not, but I have not taken my modem and antenna out and walked around the house yet. You know, humbly, I might suggest you might talk to him about the Blazing Hog.
What's that then?
Well, I mean, it's on AT&T network. If you look at it, it's covered under most of the country. You know, supposedly, if I were to take this modem with me to a con, you know, if it was in a saturated area, it would pick up. And most of the places, it looks like it would be saturated. So, you know, I'm not sure this is worth sticking it in my suitcase and losing it, perhaps. But, you know, for somebody who's mobile, I'm thinking that might certainly be a possibility.
Well, he's already got AT&T cellular internet.
Oh, okay, so yeah, same network.
Could he hook up like a Skull Canyon Nook in his truck and then use a laptop? Has his truck be the server?
Well, he has rejected out of hand any kind of fixed capability. Even though technically getting a small form factor and putting in GTX, you know, 970 or whatever would be the cheapest solution.
Well, I would kind of say, you know, if there's people don't want the help, then they don't get the help.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Well, also, he has, he doesn't trust refurbished machines, so he wants to pay the dummy tax.
Then mark cheap off the list.
As I say, he wants a rugged off-the-road Ferrari.
And I take it open source is not an option with him.
Only if it runs the specific Windows game that he's got himself addicted to.
Sounds like you need to find him a new addiction.
Well, he wants what he wants, and when I give him... After all, everybody knows that I don't know anything about computers.
Well... You know, I'm looking at the ProtonDB database and, you know, installing stuff, gold and platinum and all that. And like I said, still not working for some reason. I need to go in the config. But, a lot of these things, bought the license, dropped back into Windows to use it, as much as I hate that. And a lot of that is, okay, well, I've got a laptop sitting here that can do my Linux things, you know, my internet things, since I'm in Windows, you know, the only thing I'm going to do is games. It's not I'm going to browse or surf or do anything more touches the web than I have to. But it's like... Yeah, I would like this one machine that I do a game and I come out of the game and I'm stuffed rather than having to reboot the whole thing.
Well, I'll throw Facebook Marketplace, MSI, at him tomorrow if I remember it. But I may just have to step out of the way of the falling tree.
And I'm thinking, Joe, you know, we talked about Mycroft and the new version coming out, and they said, well, it should have been out by now, we haven't got it, kind of like the last time. We're reevaluating the case because certain things had reverb and echo and whatever, and we need to do this and do that. You know, a couple of years ago, it was out of the question, and I talked to Ryan Sipes, who's no longer part of the project, and said, you know, have you talked to these guys who I saw at PentagonCon you know, they were doing thing on the phone, you know, their central thing is, well, you know, rather than going out to the service to convert voice to text and then do the search and then bring it back, you know, you would have this server in your house that would do it. And at the time, you needed at least an i5. And now we're looking at i5s, $200. You know, I want to reach out to the Mycroft guys. Hey, maybe this is time you should combine the technology and tell people, yeah, if you want to spend the $200, you can have the server in your house and not worry about everything that you say going out to the NSA.
That sounds interesting. Have you heard anything else about the Mi?
Nothing at all. And nothing about the Atari console that I invested in.
All right, real quick, just to finish up what I was talking about. So one of the fixes that was out there for this, which I think got me one step closer but wasn't the complete fix, was to make sure that QEMU-KVM and libvirt.bin were installed, and then in your etsy libvirt QEMU.conf add KVM to a group, and then you basically add yourself to that group. And but that was only like half the problem. The other problem seems to be something with there's some sort of smart card device that, if disabled, seems to work. So there's another, you know what, I should probably add these two links to the show notes. This one, it seems to be, because this, in the error message I'm getting, this seems to be the smart card thing. The device CCID card pass-through smart card DO bus seems to be the problem I'm getting when I start up GNOME boxes and try to run a box or an image or whatever in through the command line. And I just lost the page. And so it says somebody brought up it's related to the smart card device. They said if they connect to the user session invert manager and try to boot in there, it also doesn't work. However, after removing the smart card device invert manager, I can boot in and start the VM in GNOME boxes as long as it was not removed already. So I got to figure out how to do that, because this didn't seem to give me any way to do that, or it just expected that I knew how to do that, and I think that might actually solve my problem. At this point, I'm wondering why I'm fighting so hard to try to get things running with GNOME boxes.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, you know, since I said earlier, well, I've got a cloud server, remove the smart card technology because it's a physical device. You know, why is that important? You know, I mean, is smart card a security protocol independent of the physical device?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's supposed to be like a virtual smart card device that the Vert Manager is creating. I don't know.
Well, as to my laptop here, it's got a smart card reader in it, in lieu of the express card slot.
Yes.
The system may be loading up a driver for that, and if it doesn't find a card, it may be getting confused.
Right. I think the issue is I got to figure out how to get it to stop doing that, and I'm not as smart as the people who found the problem to be able to stop it.
Well, it's at least you know who to ask,
right?
Oh yeah, I run into that all the time. Particularly, like I said, the page we had from a show ago, you know, do matter most through Docker, and you look at it and yeah, now's where you set up the database, and it's like they assume you know how to do that. So I found that other page that I think is more handholding, and if it isn't, I'll find another one. Because there are so many server applications that need a database. So, you know, maybe if I finally learn that sort of thing once, that will be something that sticks with me.
Also, you may want to look at MaraDB, I think it is.
Yeah, that's definitely another possibility.
Since MySQL is sort of getting locked down more and more.
Yeah, but for a single purpose like that, I think SQLite was probably the best way to go. And when I was setting up the Etherpad Docker image, I did have to set up a database container and then a Etherpad container and then link them together. But there was the one, the stuff I had found had basically kind of, like you said, handheld me through setting that up, so.
Okay, here we go. I've got through the whole show, but Conky was breaking up for me and probably just me in that last segment.
Maybe you had some points a little bit earlier where you were breaking up.
Okay, well, I wouldn't have known that. And you came through perfectly clear that last time.
What do you think? Is it time to shut it down?
Yeah, I'm getting tired.
I think we've covered everything.
I think you're right.
I did get through the last Orville right before the show. And we'll discuss that a different time, maybe. And I still have Gotham to watch tonight. And I did bring a movie home because Redbox uncharacteristically said, you know, we'll knock this much off of one movie rather than, you know, you do two movies. So there was one movie I wanted to watch on Redbox, and I got that.
Which movie was it?
Oh, crap. I knew you were going to ask me that. It was like a submarine movie.
No idea. Sorry.
Hunter Killer. There was a deal the other day, you know, one of the two-for-ones, and looked through and said, oh, well, I can only see one that I really want to see, and it was that.
Cool.
I really think Redbox is starting to fight for market, so until they go under, you know, it's all good for consumers.
And they're like, what, a buck a night or something like that?
More like $2. They do have like a streaming service that is really not competitive with Amazon. Well, you know, kind of like Amazon. You know, there's a lot of stuff I don't want to drive into town that, you know, well, probably I'm not going to spend a dollar's worth of gas, but, you know, you know, it's kind of a toss-up.
You know, thinking about it, at $2, I mean, what is it to rent most movies off of Amazon? Like, 3, 4?
Yeah, 4 or 5 off of Amazon. First run, at least.
Yeah, I think, you know, not necessarily a high definition, but whatever the regular definition, the standard definition is, a lot of them look like they're about like $3.99.
I mean, I'll do stuff like the season of Doctor Who because it's just, you know, for what the price they have, it's not worth doing piracy.
Right. I think about the only plus side to Redbox is, you know, I can bring the DVD home and use Handbrake on it. And
right. Like I said, Redbox is a streaming service, but if I was them, I would price it the same as, you know, renting the movie. And it's like, no, they've got it twice as much as if you got the movie out of the box.
Well, the only thing my brother has had with Redbox is that if you can't get the when we back into one of their machines, things get expensive.
Yeah, I know that. I've had that a few times that, you know, as I'm planning to get it back and then things happen.
Well, I have to say, gentlemen, that I'm not as young as I used to be, and I'm fading fast.
No, I think, and it's my fault, this has probably been one of our longer episodes.
I'm just pointing out my own fading energy, not complaining at all.
All right, 50, you want to play us out, or?
Yeah, I guess so. We started with Father Finch, and he couldn't hold with us the whole time, but he's still near and dear to our hearts. But I've been 5150, your interim host, and alphabetically, there's Honky Magoo.
Good night, all.
And then there's Joe, twice.
Yep. Good night, everybody.
And last again, but absolutely never least, Nat Miner.
Well, 50, think of yourself as a closer, a specialist.
Well, I certainly will. I'm definitely probably the second oldest in the cast.
Good night, all.
Oh, there's this whole spiel I'm supposed to read. Just a minute. Our next recording will be February 15th, 2019. Our music is Downright, which is awesome, by Klaatu and Brome. We also want to thank Delwyn for his use of the Mumble server and for the bot module to find the next recording date. If you need to, is type .ns in our IRC Freenode channel. We'd also like to thank Triple Zero Web Host for our web hosting. Finally, we'd like to give a special thanks to Kay Wisher, Father Finch, and Tony Bemis for all their help supporting over the years. And Honky, there in that context, is spelled T-H-E-I-R, and I'm being a jerk.
Nope. I have no problem with anybody correcting my spelling. I have horrible, horrible spelling.
And is this the end?
I'm not doing it. Good evening, Netminer.
Good evening. How do I sound?
You sound really good.
I have a question for you, Honky. What kind of gaming laptop would you recommend for a guy who lives in a truck?
That would be probably a question that would be better suited for Joe when he shows up, because he is much more of a gamer than I am, and he pays a lot more attention to a lot of the hardware that's out there when it comes to things like gaming than I do. Hey there,
Father
Finch. Hello, Father. Unfortunately, we couldn't hear you.
I think the problem I see it is that he's trying to keep up with the desktop gamers, and anything that he can afford is not going to survive very well inside the truck.
I guess it also comes to, too, I mean, like, what type of games is he playing?
Well, he's playing a game which will not allow integrated graphics to work very long.
So, not being much of a PC gamer, what does that mean? He would need some. That would be a power issue, wouldn't it? Or is it just? Again, I'm not sure what that would mean.
GPU issue. He needs to have a gaming GPU, and they don't generally come in affordable laptop.
That's true.
Not to interrupt, but can you hear me now?
Well, you most certainly can.
Ah, and a more welcome bird we couldn't find.
I try. I come bearing seed. Wait, does that make me sound pregnant?
Possibly.
I won't touch that one.
How have you gentlemen been?
Lately cold.
Yeah.
We had quite the warm-up. We got up to almost 20 degrees above zero today. It's almost shorts weather.
Yes, my... I've been staying in and keeping my head down for the last couple of days.
That's a wise decision.
Well, I've been reorganizing some of my systems and getting ready to nuke and pave my oldest 64-bitter.
What's it running now?
I think it may be running Ubuntu 18.04. What I'm planning on doing, it's a Sempron single core with 2 gigs. I'm thinking of putting an SSD in it just to make it more livable.
Now you're going to go with something maybe a little bit lighter than just straight up Ubuntu, or...
I may actually go with something like i3.
But are you going to do something Ubuntu-based or something Debian-based, Arch-based?
Probably Ubuntu-based.
I got to say, with all my distro hopping, which I mostly stick to things that are either Debian Ubuntu, or Arch-based, I find that one of the biggest... pros I find to Arch is I think Pac-Man seems to run very quickly and very smoothly on there, and most Arch-based systems seem to be pretty, I'm not sure if they're necessarily lean, but they seem to be a little bit snappier.
Well, I might try one of those, but I'm planning on making this basically a server and only having enough graphical interface so that I don't absolutely have to be command line type.
So, can I offer you basically two kind of challenges? One would be, so there are many versions of Debian out there, and there is the net install version of Debian, which I believe you can get, and you can get you can start off with a desktop and either very minimal, I still think it's very minimal, but they still give you like a handful of stuff. My other suggestion is, I know Manjaro has a Architect Linux version of Manjaro, which is kind of like their net build. But if it's Architect, the idea behind Architect was that you basically are given a end curses screen where you kind of choose all the things that you want to install, and then it kind of does all of the heavy lifting of the setting up of an Arch system. So I believe if you could, when you're done with that, you could have it set up so it's a very bare bones desktop manager and GUI and barely nothing else in the back end, or you can go Ubuntu server and then try to install a GUI on top of it.
Yeah, the one thing first. My systems are running pure Ubuntu's, Zubuntu mostly. So that's where I am now. Yeah, I would think of going with a net install. I've got gobs of disks. I've got 2 gigs of main memory. And I have 120 gigabyte SSD here, which I can throw in as an OS drive to make that a little more responsive.
Now, how do you want to use the server? What do you want it to do?
Basically, it's going to be just a backup disk and maybe doing some caching for devs and whatnot. Not much, really. I'm just going to see what I can do and experiment.
So basically, network storage.
Network storage and working with like X2Go and that sort of thing as its primary interface, and maybe web admin.
Now, how did you, which type of file sharing application, I don't know the proper wording for it. Like, you to go with Samba, FTP, do SSHFS?
I'm thinking SSHFS. I would almost go personal file sharing. No personal file sharing, but I think that's a little too open.
Well, when it's on your home network, I wouldn't worry about how open it is. If there was like any ports open on your home network or something like that that would make you feel uncomfortable, then maybe you would worry about like how open it is. But like I have Samba set up, but I have Samba set up with like completely open, that any like basically if you're on my network, you could probably find it.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Hey Joe.
Buenas noches, Joe.
Hello.
So Joe, are you guys going to do on Mintcast, are you guys going to do a deep dive into Docker?
I think I'm going to keep that separate and do an HPR for it and link it. And mostly that'll be command structure and the various things you can do with the commands that are built in and maybe some of how other people set up various commands. Yeah, our deep dives lately haven't been all that deep.
I think you were talking about how you were doing an evaluation of Flatpaks and all the other packaging.
Right.
I'm not a listener of Mintcast, but did you guys go through that yet?
Yes, we did. That was our most recent show last week.
All right, I'm going to have to squeeze that one in.
Also, I may optimize this system for basically a static browsing experience.
You lost me there, Netminer. What do you mean by that?
I mean, most of my machines are powerful enough to run, let's say, YouTube video. But with this older machine, if I'm just looking at Linux blogs and stuff like that, I don't need nearly the horsepower.
Got it.
Well, the fact that it dogs at YouTube is just don't do YouTube.
You sound like you're almost a candidate for like anti-X.
Yeah, I don't know what anti-X is about, so I'd like to. I would probably look into that.
Yeah, it's a, I don't want to say lean, but it's a machine, or it's a distribution targeted for lower-end machines. And I just put it on about 2 weeks ago on an old Celeron laptop that's actually a 32-bit, and it runs pretty smoothly. I was using it at work today.
Well, I have an old P4 sitting here that I would like to regenerate. I'm going to either regenerate or scrap.
Is Anti-X Arch-based, or is that Debian-based?
It is Debian-based.
Is that one that they that kind of they did after people who liked CrunchBang kind of kept up with and they renamed or whatever?
No, I think you're thinking about Bunsen Labs.
Oh, okay.
No, Anti-X is a project. They also have a, gosh, I can't remember the other one. There's like a sister project that's made by the same developers. Let me look that up.
Are we talking Memphis?
Ding, 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 ding.
Howdy, folks.
Hey, 50.
I'm surprised. The looks like for once Pulse Audio automatically detected I was using headphones and switched to them.
Well, that's good. So Anti-X is systemd free, huh?
Yeah, I was a little bit shocked the other day when I had to start a service instead of system control.
Wow. Welcome, Father Finch. What do we owe the honor tonight? You didn't have to work?
Yep, I didn't have to work, and I remembered that there was a show taping tonight, so I hooked everything up.
Sweet.
Now, I'm going to... Down the road, I may put another 2 gigs of memory in this old Sempron. It's officially maxed out, but on my old Dell, it maxed... I found doubling up the memory over what it recommends was doable.
And I apologize. It looks like I puked all over the show notes this week. It's a sort of a productive week.
Could you put the link up for the show notes so that I can see how productive you've been?
Yeah, it's both in the IRC and now in the Mumble channel.
Twice in the Mumble channel.
Joe, I like how you put in the show notes, 3D printing ain't easy.
Right.
Well, he's still ahead of me. I've got 2 sitting here that haven't been used.
What, 3D printers?
Yeah, I got one that was supposed, you know, was really cheap and did come out, had bad reviews and didn't immediately start working for me, so I kind of left that and then had the cable company everybody gets cables from, they had
Monoprice,
yeah, they had an open box and I couldn't resist the price, so
no, because I have the Monoprice Maker Select V2.
Yeah, I heard you say that on Tilt, so I think you're a step above me. I just have the cheap one.
Well, this one's not all that expensive. I think you can get the open box for $199, but I ended up paying like $230 for mine, and it was all set up.
Well, mine was like under $100 open box. That's why I said I
couldn't present. Okay. Well, they also make the Monoprice Minis. So I don't know if you got one of those or what.
Yeah, I think that's what. Well, it's a 3P, whatever that. I don't think they make one any smaller than that. It's, I think, and Joel said the same thing. It looks exactly like the printer he got if they reversed it and put the LCD panel on the other side.
Ah. Now this one has the whole base station is separate. I mean, it's connected by wires, but it's easily movable.
And this one does have a bed, which the first one I had that didn't have. So, and also, you know, auto leveling, things like that. So,
auto leveling is nice. I've had to do my own.
I know this is semi heretical here, but does anyone believe that switching to Wine 4.0 is worthwhile?
I guess that depends on what you're doing with it.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask what's new. I know that, you know, kind of their code equivalency is still stuck with XP. At least that's the last I heard.
And there's a couple of other projects that have forked off of Wine that a lot of people swear by. I mean, PlayOn forked off of Wine, and then Lutrix forked off of that.
Yeah, I've got my own, it's in the show notes, but beginning the show, I've got my own story about PlayOn.
Yeah, from what I understand, there really hasn't been a whole lot of development for PlayOn recently, and that's why everybody has switched over to Lutris.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'll probably take a look at that and see, you know, if it can do anything like I would want to do.
Well, when I used Wine Config, it actually has Windows 7 in it.
Okay, well, maybe they have caught up. They'd almost have to, because, you know, a lot of your recent programs, they wouldn't even install on XP, Windows programs.
Yeah, well, yeah, Windows 7 was great. Was the last Windows I really liked, but
8.1 wasn't terrible if you tweaked it.
Yeah, I mean, classic start menu would fix
exactly.
Most
8. And you gained more backwards compatibility with 8.1 than you had with 7.
Yeah, what I basically run is the portable apps, which is all open source anyway. Just like to have the capability of running them. Also, at my local library, the portable apps platform can be run using open source software on their Windows 10 machine. And on a USB 3 flash drive, it's pretty fast.
So did Father Finch mention connecting and then moving himself to the listing booth and muting and defting himself?
No, not that I heard anyway.
Okay, well, let's give him a few minutes, I guess. He must have had something happen on his end.
Here's another FMPEG, sort of usage. If you use the SlimJet browser under Linux and you have FMPEG in, you can download YouTube videos as either video only, video and audio, or audio only. So if you like cracking them so you can get your songs or your podcasts in audio only form, SlimJet will do it, though under Linux you may have to go through some hoops to get FMPEG installed because, I guess, patents or what have you.
Yeah, that's what YouTube DL is for.
Yeah, but I can see that if it will download just audio, that way you don't have to, you know, have the bandwidth to download the video too, and
right.
Then strip the audio out.
Right, which is what YouTube DL does. Pulls the whole thing down and then strips out the audio and then possibly deletes the video depending on what you tell it.
Really? I thought it just basically stripped the audio out as it was downloading.
No, it all the conversion happens on your side of things. So it downloads everything, it strips out the audio, and you can tell it to either keep the original or delete the original.
Huh. Because when I've done it, I've just chosen what to download. Do I want the video and stuff, or do I want just the audio? And it seems like it just downloads the audio file.
Maybe. I thought it downloaded everything and then stripped it out.
It might. But it didn't. If so, it doesn't appear that way. And when it does it, I can't tell you what it's actually doing.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what SlimJet is doing, but it's a nice addition to. You can browse, and then if you want to save something, you can. It will put on the page a download video. You can select what quality or what part you want.
Yeah, okay. Doing some reading, it looks like you can just pull the audio.
Now, does anyone know how heavyweight an Electron application is?
I'm not sure what an Electron application is.
No, I don't think we covered that the other day, so I'm not sure either.
It's supposed to be some sort of browser-based, or at least draws heavily on your browser capabilities, but I've got a terminal program supposedly inspired by Tron that I'd like to try, which is one of the reasons why I may put it on my server, because it's a multi-tab terminal. It's actually designed for touchscreen use, but it will use a keyboard. And it will also respond to a mouse because of the on-screen keyboard.
I don't want to see that.
Just for posterity's sake, Antiax and MX Linux are the ones I was thinking about, which They're kind of like a combination or a spiritual successor to Mephis.
Well, I see Father Finch has rejoined us. Are we about ready to start the show?
Sure.
Well, I nominate Father Finch to host since he hasn't been here in so long.
Well, how about at least the introduction?
I'll take that.
One problem is that I used Control-T for my push-to-talk button. That doesn't work well with Firefox.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my God, it's Hacker Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like a guest, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll get back.